Welcome to this podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. I am Stefan Glaze and I am the Dinwoodie Simulation Fellow here at the College. I'm also a trainee in the Thames Valley region. Today we're going to be talking about the latest standards from the Association of Simulated Practice in Healthcare. They were published back in November 2023. So to discuss them, I'm joined by three professors who are outstanding in their fields. I've got Professor Cristina Diaz-Navarro. She's a consultant anaesthetist with an interest in neuroanaesthesia. She's academic head of the perioperative care department at Cardiff and Vale University Health Board. She's an honorary professor at the School of Medicine at Cardiff University. She's an associate professor for the School of Medicine and Healthcare Sciences at the University of Barcelona. She's a chair of the Board of Trustees of the Chalk Foundation, a chair of the Scientific Committee for the European Medical Simulation Society, and executive committee member at the Association for Simulation Practice. And she is one of the key authors of this document that we're discussing today. Professor Makani Purva was another author, and she's a consultant anaesthetist. She's just finished her tenure as Chief Medical Officer at Hull University Teaching Hospitals. She's a Professor of Simulation at Hull York Medical School, and she was the key author of the first edition. And finally, Professor Mary Mashambi, she's a consultant anaesthetist. She's Difficult Airway Society Professor of Anaesthesia and Airway Management and Associate Professor at the University of Leicester, where she's the University Lead for Simulation. So thank you so much for joining me. And I wonder if you might just introduce yourself by name and maybe, given your role keen educators, tell us who your favourite group is to teach.
Okay, that's a fantastic question to start with. Thank you, Stefan, for having us. So I am Cristina, anaesthetist by background, Spanish by birth, Welsh by heart. My favourite group of learners is actually simulation educators. Faculty development is where I feel most at home.
Great, thank you, Cristina. Purva.
Yes, hello everyone. So where do I start? Because I love teaching, and give me an opportunity to teach and I will teach. But my favorite group are actually the actual team members in the real world. Because my favorite environment to teach is in situ. So spot teaching, in situ simulation teaching with the real team from a multidisciplinary background is my favorite.
Great, thank you. And finally, Mary.
Thank you very much. I'm Mary, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this podcast. It's really a great honor and a privilege to be here today. So I've now retired from clinical practice, and I'm now only doing teaching to undergraduate medical students at the University of Leicester. And I've discovered that I absolutely enjoy teaching medical students, especially simulation teaching, because they're never bored. Students love simulation and they always want more sessions. So I really love it. So thank you again for inviting me today.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us. Yeah. And I've got a keen an interest in teaching that I'm developing as a trainee. And I really enjoy watching people start their first placement in anaesthetics or in intensive care. It's amazing to see doctors or clinicians who have come from other specialties discover all that we do and quite quickly learn a lot about it in those first few months in the novice period. So, yeah, it's great. Thanks so much for introducing yourself. Welcome, Cristina, Bella, Mary. So today, as I briefly mentioned, we are going to be talking about the latest edition of the Standards for Simulation-Based Practice, and that's from the Association of Simulated Practice in Healthcare. You'll hear us refer to them as ASPE for short throughout this podcast. So, Cristina, you're one of the main authors on this. What are these standards and how have they come about?
So I think the first thing to mention is that they are not original standards. They are a revision. The first ASPE standards were published in 2016. And what they tried to do then was describe what was necessary to design and deliver effective simulation education and practice. And to be honest, they've been so helpful to so many professionals like myself in the development as educators. I think that perhaps the needs of our faculty, the needs of our learners, and the way that we deliver simulation, the options available, have changed with time. And in the 2023 edition, what we have done is evolve and catch up with the reality of life.
Great. So, Purva, you were involved in the first standards as well. What was going on in simulation at the time to result in those standards being produced?
It was a very interesting time when we started off on the journey on creation of the standards. I think there was a real desire to having something which would act as an impetus for simulation educators and for organizations who are supporting simulation. And I think this desire to improve simulation and aspire for excellence actually drove us to get the community together to start looking at the standards. So I think it was the lack of having something which was UK-driven and UK-pertinent was a starting point, but also the recognition that there were standards in other countries and that there was perhaps a need for us to create something that was more relevant for our population and our patients too. So that is what got us started on that journey all those years ago.
Great. Christine, you mentioned some things have changed in simulation at the time. What kind of things are you talking about? What technologies have added and how that's changed?
Yes, I think that firstly, simulation has become much more part and parcel of the way that we learn across undergraduate and postgraduate settings, and certainly in anesthesia. Also, the way that we use modalities for simulation, I think, has changed. I mean, new modalities are emerging. We've got virtual realities, immersive realities. We've got a different, perhaps, way of blending the different ways that we can approach learning. And also, there have been perhaps, I don't know, developments or growth, but we have as a population got better at getting it right, at getting good quality in what we deliver. And there is a lot of literature to support the way that we should be providing good quality simulation. And I think that those changes have been reflected in the updated standard.
Yeah, I think for me, what I found, there was a difference. You know, when the standards first came or when the standards were being discussed initially, there was a bit of an anxiety, because initially the anxiety was, would the standards actually stifle innovation? Would it stifle people from coming into simulation? Because we were still in so many areas, simulation wasn't even known. And many specialties, it was quite a new, it was a new kid on the block. So there was a feeling that by raising the bar, would we actually dissuade people from coming into using simulation as a modality of education. But all that has now changed, because now simulation is more accepted, that anxiety about the standards is not there. In fact, the standards is used heavily now to aid improvements and to aid excellence. But one thing I will say that is that we had to change and add was the section on values. And the I think there's a bigger recognition of the EDI agenda, especially post-COVID. There's a bigger agenda about values. I think it was always there. And this element of psychological support and safety, not just for the simulation education environment, but beyond too. All of that has become more visible, and people want it to be included in conversation. So that is why we've actually brought it into the standards. And the same with environmental sustainability. I mean, things that we took for granted perhaps previously, now we're making it more explicit so that it is actually recognized as an integral part of all our teaching and training.
Great. Now, obviously, these weren't a quick weekend job on a quiet on call. So what was the process in developing the latest edition of the standards, Christine?
Oh, my goodness. The process has been quite long. I think that the first thing that we did and that we did right was consult with the simulation community. We were very, very open in providing opportunities for anybody who was related to the association or not to come to online sessions and provide their perspectives on the 2016 standards, what was working for them, how it was helping them, and what things perhaps were not quite fulfilling the need. And that was really, really important. We had already, before we started the sessions, we had already decided to include values, like Purva was explaining. And we wanted the community to tell us what values were important to them so that we wouldn't just kind of pull some words out of a hat. It would be something meaningful. So all of that consultation took a while to get through. And then we started planning our first draft. We got involvement from experts across the world to feedback on the first draft. So we had 19 peer reviewers, which I think adds to the strength of the document. And then, even then, we had a second phase consultation, which we did sharing the draft and inviting individuals and institutions to provide feedback on each element of the standards. And I think that was very, very helpful, because we have had a lot of engagement from colleges and from regulatory bodies, from commissioning bodies. So that's been really, really good in terms of ensuring that the document is as good as we can make it at this stage. And in fact, it's what has provided us a lot of support, much more than we were expecting, really, very, very early on. But I agree with something that Kurva has said before, and it is that perhaps the readiness to follow standards has changed. I think that in 2016, as educators, we perhaps were not quite so focused on where is the guidance for us to do this right. And now we're getting guidance from so many different areas. And it's just part and parcel of the way we live. You know that for assurance, quality assurance to be attained, we have to meet the standards. And that's the criterion. So the standards do help us get it right. And I think that that's very well accepted nowadays. So thanks for saying that, David. I think you're still right.
So ASPE is a very multidisciplinary group. I was struck by how many different people were there at the conference in Brighton in November. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about how that multidisciplinary nature of the society helps its function and how that will help with these standards being implemented.
Absolutely. I think the multidisciplinary is absolutely key to the standards being embraced. And also the success of the standards has been the uptake of the wider community. Now, one thing I will say about ASPE, which I think makes it quite unique, is that we have been truly multidisciplinary right from the start. And I think that is the ethos we've always projected, because we always say that patient safety is a team sport. You know, if you're going to work in teams, you train in teams. And therefore, a society like the Simulation Society should also be a multidisciplinary society. So it all follows logically in the way it was set up and the way we have continued to run it as an association. And I think one specific point I wanted to say about the standards is that the input we've had, and then Christina, of course, will agree with this. This was not just a consultation exercise where we consulted with a few of the Royal Colleges and a few of the medics and the key specialties. We truly went, you know, global in terms of endorsing all the specialties and the disciplines. And that is why I think the standards is so widely accepted, regarded, and recognized. So I think it's vitally important, because if you do not have a multidisciplinary input into the standards, it won't get accepted. If it doesn't get accepted, it's not going to get implemented. And if it doesn't get implemented, it doesn't get sustained. So it all follows in a logical fashion. So key to our success.
Thank you.
If I may add, from my point of view, I would prefer to consider them multi-professional rather than multidisciplinary, because it is not just about the different specialties. It's also about how we have ensured that all professions are represented, both in consultation and in the way that the wording has been chosen in the document itself. And in fact, some of our greatest supporters in the UK are the Royal College of Nursing and the Nursing and Midwifery Council. And they just reflect quite how we have involved across professions throughout the consultation and development process.
Yeah, it really is excellent. Just for those who may not have physically seen the standards before this podcast, I thought it would be useful just to talk a bit more about what stuff there is in the standards. And something that strikes me is quite how accessible they are. So they start with a nice summary page that covers the key points and then expand with further detail about those different points. So as you mentioned, that the words are very carefully chosen and therefore even more effective in how they communicate what standards are hoped to be achieved. But I wondered if you could just talk us through a bit about what's in it and what it tells us.
So I'll take that question, if that's all right, Purva. We've divided the document into four parts. The first part, it talks about core values. We felt it was very, very important to make the core values that the simulation community supports and feels is important very, very explicitly stated in the beginning of the document. And the first value is safety. And this is psychological safety, but also physical safety for learners, faculty, and for our patients. And quite an in-depth look to what that means, and quite a lot of references to how we can ensure that that safety does happen. The second value is equity, diversity, and inclusion, and being respectful of our differences and the differences of our learners. We're also emphasizing the importance of sustainability from an ecological perspective, but also from a program sustainability and faculty sustainability perspective, and even workforce perspective. And also, we should strive for excellence, and that's the fourth value. The second part looks at faculty, how the people that make simulation happen can be encouraged and supported in being as good facilitators as they can be. And we have included this year into faculty both simulated participants and technicians. And I think that that's a very important recognition, because faculty is not only the people who teach, it's the whole team that takes part in that learning experience. Then we have organized the what happens in simulation under the heading activity. And I think that that's a very, very important addition. That was the idea of having activity classified this way came from our colleague Michael Moneypenny, who has been also one of our co-authors. And I think it's quite clever the way he thought of it, because you look at what you need to do in preparation for the activity, how you need to facilitate it, and what you need to do after the activity, how you need to evaluate it and perhaps research it if that's what you want to do. And a standard on simulation research has been written. It's the first time that this is included into the document. And then the fourth part is about resource management. And the resource management piece has been led by Purva, because she's got that managerial level and that expertise that has made them actually very relevant and very meaningful to that part of the standards. And I've got to say, the person who led the core values piece was Colette Loss-Chapman, who's the president of ASPI. She's an ESBE background. But again, we've been multi-professional at all aspects of the development of the document, and I think that that just makes us stronger. And I would like to know from Mary, may I ask you, when you've come across these standards and considering your current position in education, how do you think they can help you?
Well, thank you. That's a really good question. And I remember reading the standards and thinking to myself, how am I going to apply this to my job? And again, to just reinstate what I do, I just look after medical students and it's undergraduate simulation. So how does it help me? These standards are fantastic in that they act as a benchmark of how we should run simulation, looking at it from different aspects such as facilities, the interprofessional faculty, the delivery itself, and also how to evaluate the delivery. And then they also standardize the terminology that we use to describe the components of simulation teaching. So I really find that really useful. But for me, several areas really stood out for me that I really wanted to capture and look at it. One was the sustainability, particularly avoiding wastage. You know, in simulation, we waste so much paper documents, single-use equipment, and also even looking at long-term disposal of sort of outdated or broken mannequins, etc., which require replacement. How do we go about that? So that's really an area that we need to think about and see what can we do about it to address that, to really reduce our impact on the environment. The second issue, which I really liked, was you've mentioned that equality, diversity, inclusion. Thankfully, it's already an area that we're all addressing, but the standards reinforce this, especially in how we include it in the faculty, the people involved, and the content, to make sure that it does cover different racial backgrounds, and even the content to make sure that it covers various aspects that we see in the population. So that was really quite instructive. The third thing I liked, and again, this was mentioned by Purva and Christina, is the simulation technicians. You know, without any doubt, we all value them. They work in the backgrounds and they're actually important. And what it made me think was suddenly, actually, do we look at their own educational and development needs? I don't know. And it's something I've never thought about. And therefore, it's something that I thought, you know, I'm going to look at it, because they work hard, but in the background. The fourth thing that I really liked was the mention of the simulated participants. Also the terminology. Hopefully it will standardize that terminology. But having just been involved in the interviews to appoint simulated participants literally in the last 2 weeks, the standards have really made me look closely at their training, their job description, and the appointment process. So those are some of the things that I really picked up. The last one was resource management and looking at long-term strategies. You know, getting funding is a real challenge for all of us. And the standards, they give us a clear framework of the resource management. It doesn't give you a solution, but it supports our aims and it gives us some outlines of how to go about it.
That's amazing, Mary. It's really quite interesting for me to hear how you're actually leaning on the standards to move forward. And that's the way I felt when I was developing as an educator. I felt that having the previous standards was giving me some sort of guidance of what to aim for and what to do. And I'm just thinking, Purva, you started this process because you led the 2016 iteration. How does this make you feel to see how far we've come?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's wonderful to see how far we have come. And also, I think picking up on your point of the using or recognizing the different members of a team delivering simulation, Mary, your point on the technicians. I think Christina and me will remember the conversations we had on where we will place the technicians in the standards. And I think putting them in the faculty section was the right thing to do and giving them the same status that they deserve because they are extremely important members of the simulation community. And so for me, seeing it travel from its first iteration where we had, if you look at it, the technicians, we had it as a standalone section to seeing it evolving and integrating into the rest of the simulation faculty is one big change. And of course, the addition of the values and the sustainability aspects makes it even more relevant, I think, for the simulation world of today. So absolutely excited to see actually where it will go with the third iteration in a few years.
This makes me think that there is perhaps a parallel between the way that we work in simulation and the way that we work in anesthesia. I think that anesthesia as a specialty is growing with regard to sustainability and with regard to considering the whole team important, whatever role we have in it. And I think that perhaps that's what we're doing in simulation as well, isn't it? Maybe that is why having three anesthetists as authors of the new standards makes a difference, because there is that parallel.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I think we have a very big responsibility for the next generation of simulation educators and the community, that the standards are aspirational for many, and we need to make those standards truly a vision for the future. So, you know, a lot of times we stop short of making the standards aspirational because we think, oh, it's not possible. Let's not make it too difficult to attain today. But I think truly we should make it aspirational and push ourselves even harder than where we are today. So completely agree in putting in things into the standards, which will make our simulation community rethink perhaps what they are doing. I agree. As anesthetists, we're probably slightly ahead of the game because we entered simulation a lot earlier than a lot of other specialties. But I think the other specialties should not have to go through everything that we did. They should start off at a much higher phase, and therefore they should reach the standards that we have set more quickly and easily too. So yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I was wondering whether what you're saying, Purva, is reflected in the fact that we're being supported so broadly. And I don't know if Mary, you know this, but the ASPE standards have been endorsed by the European Society for Simulation and by other societies across the world, the Spanish one, Portuguese, Chilean, Argentinian. Also in AXEL, which is an international nursing simulation society, has endorsed them. And we've got the official support of the commissioning bodies across four nations, which I think is really lovely, you know, for us having been part of the process to see that the standards are being accepted and endorsed and used this way. There are plans for translations to other languages already, and they've only just been launched in November, and we are now in January. So I think that's quite a nice thing to see, really. Other than the fact that working with Purva, Colette and Michael has been a real pleasure and an honor, to see that the document itself is already being used for this reason.
And I think a big testament to that, Christina, is we've stayed loyal almost to the way we designed it in the first standard, in the sense that we kept it really simple. So, you know, the points that Mary raised, one of the things I also perhaps I should ask Mary is, you've seen our standards. You're conversant with standards generally because, you know, we use standards all the time for the rest of our clinical practice. One of the things we specifically wanted to make, and probably that's why the reach has also been very good, is keeping it really simple. Is that something that you found was useful, or did you feel you needed more material, or where did you place our standards in comparison to the wider field of standards, if I can use that word?
Having written guidelines myself, I found the ASPE standards, they're very practical. And what I did is, when I got back to my unit after I came to the meeting, I actually sat down with my team and I said, let's go through this and let's look at what areas are we doing well and what areas do we need to improve? And I'll give you an example. The areas that I felt we were doing well, which were highlighted in the standards, was the collecting of feedback, documenting and acting on that feedback in order to improve the future simulation teaching. And we do that with QR codes. It's so easy to get feedback at the beginning, at the end. And then we meet at the end of our simulation session and we say, okay, this is the feedback. How can we improve it next time? And that's been really, really useful. And we've engaged with that. The other thing which was mentioned, again, which I thought was a good thing, which you mentioned, was running pilots in order to clarify your intended learning outcomes. And I think that's so useful rather than just going straight in and doing a full-blown thing. And I'll give you an example. I wanted to introduce teaching ultrasound guided venous cannulation to medical students because I think it's a really important skill for foundation year. So I ran a pilot session, which was just invited whoever wanted to come. And it showed me firstly one thing, that it was popular because it was oversubscribed. We had a waiting list. So I knew there was a need. And when we ran it, honestly, the feedback was just amazing. And the medical school, I couldn't believe it. I got funding for probes, funding for phantom limbs, and we've already rolled it out. We've already done the current fifth year students. So, you know, doing that was really useful, and it's something that's going to be taken forward. But we also noticed areas that we were not good at. And the one I will mention, because this is something that I'm sure lots of people are going to come across, is faculty. One of the things you emphasize is having trained faculty. Now, it's a lot easier said than done. When I run one of my busiest simulations, so we do 500 medical students, okay? The faculty I have are probably over the week 50 minimum. Now, if they come from a pool that's changing, they change regularly. So there's no way I can train them to say, next year you'll be doing, because they'll be gone. It's all the junior doctors. So how do I train them thinking they'll come back next year? They don't. A completely new pool of doctors. So I find that a challenge. I don't have an answer yet.
I do. I think that we have to be creative when it comes to faculty training. And I'm saying this from my experience as an associate dean for simulation in Wales. I think that we have to embrace this new digital era. And I think that if you're going to have lots of new faculty, having online resources and having short sessions to brief them into what is expected to happen is the way forward. Otherwise, you just cannot make it happen. If you've got 50 people to train every year, how are you going to fit that in with the rest of the things that you need to deliver? But if you had online materials so that everybody who on board has to go through the online materials and maybe an introductory session, that is this. And I'm happy to help you with that if you need. So we can keep going on about this conversation at a later stage.
Yeah. But, you know, again, Christina, I agree with you. We do send them a booklet with all the information. Yeah. And I can vouch that some of them will turn up and say, what am I doing? You know, they haven't read it. And you're thinking, I send you everything, you know. It's, I don't know.
Exactly. But that's why I'm saying what I'm saying, the way I'm saying it. I don't think booklets cut it. I think that nowadays people will not sit and study prior to getting things done because life is running fast. Mm. And perhaps, you know, even the way that we are doing this podcast, this is something that you can listen in the car as you're going to work. That sort of thing works. So a combination of podcasts, short videos, something that can be done perhaps a little bit quicker than going through a booklet. Mm. Something that is a little bit more interactive, something with games in it, something that will not take a long, long time. And you say, okay, this is the time that you have to prepare yourself for this. You have to devote a morning to going through these materials, and that's the bare minimum. Then I have to see you for 1 hour and we will have a chat. And then you know what you have to do when you come. I think that's probably the way forward. But again, it does require for us to embrace a new way of being. I mean, I've been an anesthetist for 27 years, I've just been reminded. And when I started doing my job as an anesthetist and my job as an educator, the expectation was different and the way that we behaved and learned was different. I think that preparing materials that can be looked into quickly and contain the essence of what matters is really, really hard work and it takes a long, long time. But I also think that we have to get better at it because that is the way that we can reach our audience.
Just a thought, it's an interesting discussion about faculty because obviously you are all leads and kind of organising from a very a kind of a level above of how simulation runs, but many people who are listening to this podcast would be people who might turn up every now and then as a faculty member. And even as one of those myself, you know, are helping with faculty, these standards were interesting to me because they challenged me about how I behave as a faculty member to say, you know, how am I engaging with my professional development? How am I ensuring psychological safety? What am I doing to submit to these core values and kind of to advance them? Have you found that you've been able to use these standards as a tool to support faculty development in that kind of way?
Of course. You know, if you want to set up a faculty development program, the standards give you an idea of what you need to cover. But my question is going to be the other way around, Stefan, and I'm putting you on the spot. As a faculty that comes to courses ad hoc, what do you think would work for you if you were going to receive a little bit of training, just enough to get you on the right path? How would you best receive it, or what would work best for you?
Yeah, I think it's, as you say, it's got to be a balance between very personal feedback about how I behave in the teaching environment. And that's something, you know, the debrief of the debrief for simulation is one of the best ways I've learned as a simulation faculty member in terms of how I generate good learning conversations, how I create psychological safety in the environment. You know, having that personal feedback, often the most effective teaching, but it's not always possible on a busy teaching day. Outside of that, I think, as you say, it's easy to access this material. So I know, for example, NHS England have just published their first 6 modules of the faculty development program, which is an excellent introduction. And so that's on my to-do list of things to work through. Is they're quick to access. It's bite-sized e-learning that, you know, it's a format we're all used to now. As much as we hate mandatory training, it is relatively easy to do it whenever you've got 15, 20 minutes free. And so that kind of thing can encourage continuing professional development. And something these standards do is bring that to be a kind of a national standard rather than, you know, locally. It's very easy to end up on the list of people who get emailed to help with simulation. But actually this says, you know, we all can improve and we can all do that. And if we're going to do that, we need something that we can all use nationally and more unified approach to that.
And can I just come in on that? Because I think it's such a valid point, because years ago when I had to set up a simulation session and I insisted that if you didn't attend our faculty development program, you can't deliver a course. There would be a big outcry amongst some of our faculty who would say, well, I've been in my specialty for 20 years, 25 years. You are asking me to come and attend. It would be all of that. But now it's accepted because the standards has actually made it easy or easier to have that conversation, because it's not, as you say, a local expectation. It's a national expectation. I think also more visible for centers or for universities or even small teams doing simulation, that this is not your one-off activity that you can just come in now and then and practice it. This is a serious modality. You've got to give its attention, its due attention, its rightful attention. And because we've also placed an emphasis on CPD, I'm hoping that simulation educators will not just see a one-off faculty development program as the start and end of their educator career, but actually as the start and an ongoing process of development for themselves. So the standards has paved the way to make those conversations at the grassroots level a lot easier, but hopefully also take us to the next level, which is how often do I need my CPD? What is my PDP? How am I going to access it? And that, again, especially if you're a consultant, will help in your job plan. It will help in your appraisal, because education appraisal is now an essential part of revalidation. So it smoothened the entire conversation and the language around how simulation is delivered. So I think the standards have been really useful. I mean, Christina, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And also, I was thinking, as Stefan was talking about his experience and how NHSE have provided materials. I come from Wales, and in Health Education Improvement Wales, there has been a lot of investment in faculty development over the last 3 years. And they have a faculty development program that is freely accessible by multi-professionals in Wales, and they can train a very large number of people, about 100 people a year, you know, for free. There's a hybrid model with the materials that are online and face-to-face sessions. And the thing is, you have the standard and it just guides you to receiving the training that is already available and that is in alignment with those standards. So I think it builds on itself and it allows institutions to enable these opportunities and to facilitate professionals to do the right thing the right way. So completely in agreement with you.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. It was the standards that really triggered me thinking about my faculty. And it's interesting because it was at ASPE that I came across the NHS England, the six modules that they mentioned. And I actually went and started doing the six modules that they give for free. And I then decided from that, that next time I'm recruiting faculty, I'm going to give them this link to say, look, this is free. You can do it at any time. And you can also choose the modules you want to do. So I think actually this is a really useful resource that I picked up going through the standards and thinking, how do I address that? And I'm hoping that this will make a difference to my future faculty. But that was one of my solutions. If you're going to say to me, what's your solution? This is one of the things that I was going to do to guide people towards this e-learning, the ELF six modules.
That's a perfect answer, actually, Mary, because you've got already modules that have been set out that are freely accessible, that your faculty can be guided to. If you top it up with a little bit of, you know, face-to-face training, then you're nearly there.
So we've mentioned a couple of different ways that we might expect people who are listening to this podcast to use these standards and change what they do. But is there anything else you thought you might expect people to do differently because of them?
I think evaluation. I think that evaluating our practice is essential to ensure its quality. And when we say evaluate, we don't just mean ask for feedback from the participants, which is very, very important. We're also thinking, let's evaluate it ourselves as faculty. Let's ensure that we are aligned with the standards in our day-to-day practice. I think that considering how you're going to evaluate what you do at early stages before you deliver the activity is really, really important, because even that exercise can help you get things a little bit better. And I also think that simulation research is evolving, and it's evolving quickly. And I think if you are starting to spend time in simulation, which is the sort of activity that takes a lot of background effort, maybe it's not a bad idea to start thinking, what am I doing that is different? What can I learn from this experience that has not been investigated before? What research opportunities are there? Who can I get to support me in getting this right? Because this is an evolving world, and we're learning so much about how to learn through this modality. I mean, there is a big field, and I certainly encourage any junior anaesthetists that are into simulation to look at what research opportunities come along with it, because it's not just good for us as a community to grow and learn, but it's also good for their CVs and for their careers. So I think that that's perhaps something that so far has been not considered with enough rigor.
One area that I'm trying to tackle is sustainability and wastage. Yeah. Because, you know, when you run simulations, we run something called ward simulations, where we used to have paper notes, requests on papers, and loads of things were just wasted. And there are two things that we're doing. One is reusing a lot of the things if we can, and really trying to encourage that. The second is we've now, and this is probably something that's going to become more common, in hospital, we now use electronic patient records. Yet in simulation, we were still using paper records. So what we're doing in Leicester, and this is still very, very early in the practice, although we've already used it in our last simulation, is having electronic patient record platform that's completely separate to the clinical live patient, and then using that to run a simulation so that you will do away with paper things. Now we haven't achieved it yet, but we're trying. But I think that's the future. But it's not easy. It's hard work, and the software is not there yet. We're not achieved it, but I think that's the way forward, that we've got to start doing what you're doing in hospitals when we're teaching simulation.
Absolutely amazing. And this is, Christina, this is such a brilliant example. Just putting in that element of environmental sustainability, zero waste, all that, I think it raises awareness. You might have still done it, Mary, actually, even without the standards. We'll take the credit for it. But I think for others, I mean, this podcast, when others hear it, it'll get them thinking along the same lines, what else they can do. And it doesn't have to be something perhaps as ambitious. It can even be simple things like what you said earlier, you know, the reducing the waste. Are you using paper scenarios? So it's all those sort of things, isn't it? So, you know, truly remarkable that we are changing the way we're doing things too.
It's been a really useful conversation, everyone. Thank you so much. So we've covered a lot of different ground here in this podcast, talking from the ASPE standards about practice in simulation. I wonder, what particularly would you think you'd want people listening to this podcast to do differently because of this?
So for me, it's quite clear. The standards are about facilitating quality in simulation-based practice. And what I would say is that you probably have to do four things to get it right. One is train your faculty. Second one is plan your simulation right. Third thing, pilot it. And the fourth thing, evaluate it. So train, plan, pilot, and evaluate. I think that if you start with that, you cannot go too far wrong.
Herbert, is there anything you'd add to those points?
Yeah, I completely agree with what Christina said. But what I would like to add is for the listeners, for those listeners who haven't as yet had a look at a second iteration, obviously, it's my request to have a look at it. And my suggestion would be to actually have a sort of a journal club meeting with other simulation providers in your area or region, and use the standards as a key topic of discussion. Because one of the things I was hoping the standards would do is to actually bring the simulation community closer together, have a common goal, a common motive, a common platform framework. So my message to those listeners is the standards are there to improve yourself and your own team, but also use it as a medium by which you can link up, network, and raise the profile of education across your region. So reach out, use those standards, and use it for the betterment of a bigger group, and ultimately for the patients too. So that would be my take home, the message I would give the listeners.
Great, thank you. Mary, as one of the intended audience of these standards, it sounds like you've had some excellent use of them already. Is there anything else you think that would you'd kind of want to share about them to other people listening?
I mean, thank you. I think I've already touched on quite a lot of the things that we've already changed. But I think what I would say is a little bit on what Proof has said, but probably at a more local level, is go in with your team as a simulation team, and perhaps me as a simulation lead, and have a meeting where you go through the standards and you think exactly what I said, what are we doing well? Because you want to start off with the positives and say, you know, this is what we're doing well. And then move on to the things, okay, what are the areas that we can improve? But have start that locally. You know, I always think if you start locally, you can then move to regional, to national. But you've got to change locally. And you can only do that by really going through the standards, summarize it for our team and say, this is what they say and this is what we should be doing. So I think that's really, really the way forward to change people's, it changed my way of thinking.
Great, thank you. And as I've mentioned, these are, even as someone who isn't a lead in the simulation, but as someone who comes to participate as faculty, you know, I will certainly be taking these standards into different conversations and into my own practice as a simulation faculty member. So thank you so much for producing them and sharing them. It's time to draw this podcast to a close. So thank you so much, Christina, Perva and Mary, for your time and for a really interesting discussion on this subject. And so if you want any more information, you can search for the ASPE website and you'll find the standards and the consultation process all available there. And there's more information on the college's simulation pages. So thank you very much and goodbye.
The RCOA warmly welcomes members from across the globe. So if you are based outside of the UK, we invite you to discover the array of benefits available to you as an RCOA international affiliate. To learn more about joining and to explore the benefits of membership, visit rcoa.ac.uk/international-affiliate or click on the link in the show notes.